I'm going to talk to you about protein assemblies, and the really the question that I could almost say obsessed with is how do you create new interactions during the course of evolution? And this is one question that we've been trying to address, and while trying to addressing that question, we observed, as you will see, that protein superassemblies are actually, I think, visited more frequently than we commonly assume during the course of evolution. Maybe I should close the door. So, that's not gonna work. So, one motivation to address this question is that actually this picture is a protein interaction network which Christian has been telling you about, I think. And this interaction network is placed in a room of mirrors, so you can see reflections of reflections of reflections, and that's just to symbolize the fact that we don't really understand how these networks have evolved and how they evolved today. And I think a key question that we need to address is how easily can it be to create a new link within this network? And I guess the idea is that if it's easy to create links between proteins in this network, probably that what we see today when we measure networks is not is not necessarily what we think. So, for example, we published a lot with Christian about this idea that if it's so easy to create links, maybe that not all links are functional; they are just a product of random evolution. Well, that's a basic idea. So to address this question, I'll go in I'll split the talk in two parts. The first one is about the anticipation of the existence of non-adaptive interactions. So that means interactions that arose not because they conferred a particular advantage to the system, but just because a random mutation created the interaction. And the second part will be about trying to characterize how easy it is to really trying to experimentally measure how easy it is to create new interactions. So about anticipating the existence of non-adaptive interactions, the first thing I would like to go through is the crowding environment inside the cell. So I guess many of you are physicists, and I wanted to ask to ask you a question, which would be, so imagine that. So let's assume that we are proteins, and the cell is a planet. I mean, is a box. So the question is, how big should the box be? So we maintain our size. I mean, we are protein. We are big proteins. How big should the box be to put all the population of the United States? So to achieve the crowding that you have inside the cell. So does anybody want to take a guess? Not that big, okay. So let's go by orders of magnitude. So who would go for 100 meters, 1 kilometer, 10 kilometer, 100 kilometers?
1 kilometer.
1 kilometer, okay. Okay, yeah, that's not bad actually. so to go through the calculation, I mean, a protein is on average 5 nanometers. A yeast cell is about 5 micrometers, and let's say the yeast box is 1,000 times bigger than an average protein. So if we do the same analogy, so we take a human being and we put it, we say it's 50 centimeter cube. So that would mean that and there are about 100 million proteins in the yeast cell. So for the USA, so that would be about 0.7 kilometer cube.
Is that David Emmanuel?
No. Ah, actually, yeah. I could have used my kit. Actually, I will at some point. I didn't think I would. So you see, it's pretty. I mean, it's surprisingly small. So that's just to reflect that really the cell is crowded. So it's an environment that is really a good base to create interactions. I mean, things basically bump into each other all the time. And actually, there's one very famous interaction that is triggered, and that is actually the cause of a disease by one single point mutation, and that's the sickle cell anemia causing mutation in hemoglobin. So this is hemoglobin. Normally, this amino acid is a glutamic acid. And there's one mutation in the gene of hemoglobin that makes it become a valine. And this single change makes hemoglobin form long fibers. So when I mention this example, often people say that, yeah, well, in red blood cells, hemoglobin is really concentrated, almost as concentrated as in a crystal. So surely one point mutation can make a difference. The question is, can this be observed not only in at this level of concentration, but also in living cells, basically? So there are many hints that tell us that it should be the case also in living cells, and this is one of them. So I will use throughout the talk what I like to call a stickiness scale, which is simply a scale that measures interaction propensity of amino acids. How do you measure a stickiness scale? It's quite simple. People have done it many times before, and we did it only on I think what is a better controlled set, because this is derived from only E. coli proteins. And what we took is, so you have a protein, you split the protein into three regions, the interior, the surface, and the interface. And now you can say that the interaction propensity, or the stickiness, can be calculated by the ratio of frequencies of amino acids at the interface versus the surface. So if you have an amino acid that is very rich at protein-protein interaction sites, it will be called sticky. And if a residue is rich at the surface, so it lacks the solvent, but it doesn't like to interact with other protein, it will be deemed non-sticky. And so this is a stickiness scale, which recapitulates largely hydrophobicity, basically. So you can see here on the right, you have the sticky amino acids that are richer at the interface, and you have mostly aromatic and hydrophobic amino acids. And at the left of the scale, you have the charged amino acids that are non-sticky. Yes?
This is great. Do you distinguish at all the sort of center of an interface versus the edges? I think that's
something
they really work on pretty interfaces.
Yes. So, that's a very important question. Here, to make it simple, I just say interface, but it's actually, there are three subdivisions, and we only use the core of the interface. So one major difference between this scale and, say, the hydrophobicity scale, for example, is that you will notice that arginine is here. So arginine is neutral. It's not sticky, it's not non-sticky. Whereas it's a least hydrophobic amino acid. So lysine and arginine are both positively charged, and you can see that they have very different stickiness properties. But
you going through PDB, which, as I learned from you a long time ago, PDB is overrepresented in homomers.
Yes.
So aren't you actually coming up with a scale for propensity from homomers rather than heteromers?
Yes, okay, so that's a great question. It's very much linked to the first question. And when we defined actually this, we redefined the three regions, we redefined the core, and when you use, there are many papers that were published about the idea that interfaces for different interaction types have different properties in terms of their composition. So many papers have been published because they have the specific definition for the size of the core of the interface, the rim of the interface, which is like a bit exposed to the solvent as well. So when we use the definition that was defined in this paper, then we see that whether you take homo-oligomers, hetero-oligomers, mostly these two types, they have actually, or actually, homo-oligomers, hetero-oligomers, large interfaces, small interfaces, the composition of the core of the interface is constant across all types. Only the size, the relative size of the different regions varies. So in that sense, I think it should be reliable.
I think there's no evidence that PDB is overrepresenting homomers.
It should be in the sense that people usually try to crystallize a protein on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, so in that sense, you.
Oh, I see. In
that sense.
Frequency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Relative to systems, not relative to. Yeah.
What is the idea to consider only a point. So if, for instance, A is charged, then yes, of course, A does A, but A then, if it's positively charged, then attracts somewhat some B, which is negatively charged. So you have to construct similar metrics for all pairs A and B.
Sure. So, but I mean, so a salt bridge can contribute to stabilizing an interface, but generally it won't. I mean, because the gain in energy that you get from a salt bridge is usually lower than what you get from hydrophobicity, burying hydrophobic surfaces, and this is simply because, I mean, I guess if you have a charge, it will interact with the water. If you have a hydrophobic surface, you will gain a lot of hydrophobic effect. So I mean, if you take all known interaction sites, you will see that you have some interaction sites are mostly driven by electrostatics, but these are really a strong minority.
But in general, why should I worry about A contacts?
Ah, okay. No, see, I think okay. Ah, sorry. Oh, okay. Okay. I should have been clear. This is not AA. This is frequency of amino. The AA means this means frequency. So, okay. Let's go through this. This is a log of the ratio between the frequency of amino acids at the interface. So, amino acids, all amino acids in this region, divided by the frequencies of amino acids in the surface. So, let's take lysine for example. Where this so this score means that. Lysine, this is like a, I guess, a log 2 scale. So that would mean that lysine is approximately twice enriched at the surface relative to the interface. That's what this means.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Sorry, I misunderstood.
No, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. So, and then, one thing that we could have done, I mean, and that people have done to calculate like empirical force fields, so you just look at which amino acids like to interact with which other amino acids. But then here, this is not convenient because let's say if you want to say, is this protein surface sticky? If you have contact, then it will be sticky relative to, I mean, to something. But whereas here, we just want to have an absolute measurement of stickiness that is independent of what it could stick to. So that's the stickiness scale, and we will reuse it several times. The first thing that we did actually with the stickiness scale is to measure the evolutionary distance between an average surface patch and an average interface patch. So here the experiment is very simple. You just take a virtual window, and you just roll this window over all protein surfaces in PDB, and you plot the distribution of stickiness. And then you do the same, but only considering interface patches, and you plot the distribution of stickiness. And then you can ask, how many mutations on average do I need to shift the distribution from the surface stickiness to the interface stickiness? That's a pretty simple thing to do. And so do you want to take a guess as to how many mutations are needed on average?
What's the size of the patches?
It's 1,000 angstrom square. It's actually a large patch. It's a pretty big patch. It's, so to give you an idea, this would contain about 28 to 25 amino acids within the interface. So it's pretty large.
Patch. And each patch is about 10, because it's 100 on average. So it's 10 amino acids on each half.
So. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Of 10, so 10 amino acids in the core that are well buried.
One.
Okay.
Two.
Okay. Anybody for three? Okay, so actually it's funny if you plot the two distribution. So with one mutation you go halfway, and with two mutations you overlap the two distribution completely. So it's really only two mutations on average that you need to shift an average surface patch to an average interface patch, and that means that random mutations will trigger what looks like interfaces. It doesn't tell you what it's going to stick to. But it tells you that it will actually have the property, the stickiness property of an interface. So what we can say that this is small.
So if you look, at orthologs that have clear one-to-one orthologs across all of evolutionary distance, how frequently do you see shifts? I mean, I can give you a couple of anecdotal examples.
Okay.
Clearly happen. But, I mean, this is about what I would have expected, and something I've always been perplexed by is if it is so easy to switch, so conceptually so easy to switch from a surface patch to an interface patch, why does it happen so infrequently?
So there are conflicting papers, but why do you think it's not frequent? I mean,
because for orthologs across all of all of life, we can in general do a pretty good job of structural alignments that are also consistent with the sequence alignments. But I can cite plenty of counterexamples, but there are not very many.
So, I mean, one thing that I would say, so you're talking about structures, and that brings me to just, maybe I can do a quick comment on that. Structures, I have always been puzzled by a paradox, which is that if you take PDB, you have a vast majority of monomers, and you have few, like, obligate heterooligomers. If you take data from proteomics, you have huge numbers of heterooligomers. And, I mean, you might question the validity of the data. I think, of course, some of it is not, like, valid, but lots of it is. I would say probably, let's say even if half of it is not valid, I don't think it's much less. But that still means that you have lots of transient interactions that are probably used to rewire things.
Still, but I mean, I won't dispute that. That's certainly true. And there are also all kinds of sampling biases. But I mean, you've based your analysis here on the analysis of PDB. I mean, so these are four surfaces defined by existing structures and interfaces defined by existing structures. So even if we restrict to that, I still may be interested.
This is not interface. Well, I mean, this. All I want to say here, all I want to conclude is that the surface has an intrinsic potential to stick to other surfaces or to other protein surfaces. So that what this suggests is that evolvability of interactions is of protein-protein interactions is should be high, and that reminds me of one case that it was Roger Williams at LMB that mentioned me this example. Which is, I don't remember which are the proteins should be involved in trafficking. In one species, you have A, B, C. In another species, B, the central protein, disappeared, and now A evolved an interaction with C directly, which I found amazing because that also reflects the idea that, it cannot be that difficult or that unlikely to evolve a new interaction.
This doesn't say anything about the shape. I mean, it may be easy to find a patch of sticky ones, but the average stickiness of that patch doesn't tell you whether it's got anything to fit in.
It doesn't tell you anything about what it's going to stick to. It just tells you that it should stick to something.
Or even whether there's anything of that.
Geometric complementarity, of course, is important as well. But then the way you might think about it is, okay, you have a protein, you have a sticky patch, it has vast pool of opportunities. I mean, inside the cell, you have every protein can come in any orientation. So, in that, I think that kind of even things out. One other very interesting example. It was the first paper about an interaction that was designed. It was from David Baker's lab. So what they did is they took a protein and they made a sticky patch. And they evolved, and then they found something that kind of had a weak interaction, and they refined that interaction, and then they got a crystal structure. So they designed the two proteins like this, and they saw that it was interacting like this. So it was interacting at the sticky interface, just not in the way that it was predicted. So I find it a nice example to illustrate the fact that if you are sticky, most likely that you will induce some binding, you will induce some binding. So,
I'm going to fight you on that a little more. Do you have any data or any idea on how hard it is to make a?
That's the second part of the talk. Yeah, I get to that.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I just want to understand one thing. So, from a protein perspective, you are a protein living in an aqueous environment, and you now have 1,000 square angstrom hydrophobic patch, because this is what it is. So am I a happy protein with that floating around?
So that's the thing. So I mean, you can actually view this both ways. You can say, ah, that means that surfaces on average are actually quite close to becoming sticky, or it means that interfaces are actually not that sticky. So it's kind of a balance. Of course, you have phase.
It depends on your abundance, right?
Yeah, it depends on your abundance. And generally speaking, if you make...
I'm talking about really about prison stability and the fact that you have...
I think stability doesn't matter because if you mutate a surface residue, generally speaking, it might affect stability, but in most cases it won't. Danny Tofik had a paper where he assessed the impact on the delta delta G for every mutation of every residue towards every other residue, and if you are very exposed, there are a minority of mutations that are very destabilizing, or destabilizing at all. So in that sense, so you will just create something that can stick. But that's basically what you will do. And it will probably stick.
Do you have any evidence that what you're calling a sticky patch is in fact sticky? I mean, so all you've told us so far is that it's easy to get the composition of what a sticky patch looks like.
So
you're not really shown that it's sticky.
I agree. We will get there.
Okay. But before you say the next slide, you can look at this in the other direction also, which is, this could be evidence that persons have evolved to not be very stupid because they're surrounded by, they encounter thousands of other persons.
So the next slide, So only those for which it's most dangerous have evolved not to be sticky. So that's the next slide.
Next slide.
Let's go to the next slide. Right. That's exactly. So that's something that an analysis we did with Sarah actually, and here we had the exact same reasoning. So we thought, okay, maybe if stickiness can be deleterious in the proteins where it's most deleterious, it should be selected against. And so we took all the proteins of known structure for E. coli, yeast, and human. And what we did is to plot the stickiness of the surface versus the concentration of the protein inside the cell. And we saw quite nice for biology anticorrelation. So when I say nice, it means over 0.4. When you say that protein mRNA abundance to protein abundance is like 0.7, 0.4 with stickiness and abundance is not that bad. So we did see exactly this. So when stickiness is dangerous, proteins will tune it so that it's, less prone to interaction or aggregation. So that's one thing. Now the question is, coming to your question. Classically, people think of mutations as being dangerous for folding, for stability. And the idea is that, okay, you have a protein, a mutation is acquired, then now you have a misfolded protein, and the misfolded protein can aggregate. Here, really, what we have seen, what it suggests, doesn't prove it, but it suggests that often you will have a protein, and a simple mutation will trigger a new assembly. So the question is, how frequent is this arrow? So that's the next part of the talk that we want to characterize how easy it is. So that's David. So to characterize this, obviously a mutation will never have a huge impact on affinity. So we had to use a trick to have a simple readout of a new interaction being created by single point mutations. And the trick that we use is to use symmetric proteins. And in fact, symmetric proteins, so proteins that interact with themselves, are very frequent in nature. This was observed by Monod early on. Lukatsky and Shaknovich had a few papers explaining the energetic basis of why this is the case. So actually in 2008 with Sarah we published a paper about homoligomers, and what we have shown actually was that in PDB we estimated that up to 50% of proteins actually do form homoligomers, which is quite a large number. And what we have shown is that they evolve via these routes where you have that actually these arrows are the arrows that are most frequently, the routes that are most frequently taken during evolution. So let's say you are a monomer, you can evolve toward the dimer, trimer, tetramer. So these are cyclics. They have only one axis of symmetry, which is here. You can rotate the structure. And then a dimer can evolve a new self-interaction to become a dimer of dimers, for example. and here you have three axes of symmetry, and here you have a dimer of trimers, dimer of tetramers. You could also form a trimer of dimers, but this is not the point here. So the, but what you model is that, okay, you can acquire a new self-interaction and become a dimer. The dimer can acquire a new self-interaction and become a tetramer. What I would like to ask is, what's next? So if you, what if these acquire a new self-interaction? Here the thing is, by symmetry, if you acquire a new self-interaction at the top, by symmetry it will be also acquired at the bottom. So what you will end up with are polymers. And it's common, not knowledge, but intuition that fibers are, I mean, by definition, these cannot have a controlled assembly because it's infinite in nature. And so probably one would imagine that these arrows have been are kind of selected against. However, here what we thought that we would do is use this transition as a readout for the creation of a new interaction. So the idea was to take finite protein oligomers and introduce a single point mutation and monitor whether a new whether an infinite polymer was created. So here we use this transition to test whether a point mutation did have did result in a new interaction being created. So the mutation scheme that we followed is super simple. So in order to be in order for the results to have an evolutionary meaning, we didn't use any docking, or we didn't do large libraries that we would screen. We simply said, okay, let's take this structure. Here is a lysine. Let's make it a tyrosine, and that's it. So we didn't use any fancy methods to predict which mutations would result in new interactions. So we just took charged amino acids and mutated them either to leucine or to tyrosine.
How did you choose leucine or tyrosine? I think phenylalanine was your highest on the range.
Yeah. So we didn't want to be so drastic. So I mean, we hesitated, but so we chose leucine because it's known that leucine actually likes to interact with itself, as in the leucine zippers. And we chose tyrosine because it's quite hydrophilic and yet quite sticky. So we thought it was good choices. So that's just to show you again. So we took these three and we mutated them either to tyrosine or leucine. So the jump in stickiness is actually quite large. And then the idea is that we fused the homomer to a YFP reporter. And then we expressed the homomer fused to YFP, the wild type in yeasts, and monitored expression. And then we did the same with the mutant, and the question is, would we see fibers or not? So the person who did this work was Hector, and this is the day he joined the lab. He sent me an email when he was in the taxi on the way to the airport. He said, "Hi, Emmanuel, I'm Hector. I'm in the taxi." Told him, "Hi, Hector, call me when you arrive at the gate. See you." This is from my screen. And then 2 weeks later, "Hi, Emmanuel, do you know if there is any key in the lab? I was doing the transformation. I went to dinner during the incubation process, and then went back, the door was closed." So then I thought, maybe it was not such a smart choice. But then it turns out Hector is very tall, and he found a key. I didn't know about that key. It was hidden like for years at the top of a sink. So that's Hector. And so he did really a lot of work. I mean, he did really amazing work. And he started with this protein called 1POC. So this is a homo octamer. And here there are three charged residues. And we said, OK, so let's mutate all three, either to leucine or to tyrosine. And so he did that. And he expressed first the wild type in yeast. And we saw that it was expressing fine. And then he did those three mutations. And that was actually the day he was in the microscope. It was the day that Stefan Mischnick, my postdoc advisor, was visiting the Weizmann. So we were discussing in my office, and then I'm sitting, and I see Hector like coming and looking at me and doing like walking in front of the office, and I'm wondering like what happened, and then I see my phone ringing and sends me a text message. So we went with Steve to the microscope, and so this is what we saw. We saw this fiber. So this is a yeast cell, the border, and here you have a fiber. This is when we mutate these three residues to leucine, and when we mutate them to tyrosine, which is the same thing. So you can see that this is a good indication that it's just stickiness. I mean, it's not really residue dependent. Now, what Hector did is to mutate each one individually, either to leucine or to tyrosine, to see if it had any effect. We couldn't find a single bond mutation with leucine. We always saw diffuse phenotype. However, with tyrosine, there was a single point mutation that was sufficient to trigger the fiber formation. So when you hear about protein fibers, the first thing people think about are amyloids and misfolding. So we spent some time trying to characterize those. This is one of the experiments that he did. So here we have the wild-type protein without salts. And we see that so this is a fraction of soluble protein after solidification. When we add salt with the wild type, there's no effect. However, the mutant without salt is fine, but when we add salt, it precipitates at the bottom of the tube. And the nice thing is that this precipitation is reversible. So if you pellet the protein, remove the solvent, remove water, and add water without salt, it goes back to the soluble fraction. So if it was amyloids, for sure that would not be reversible. So this is a good indication that these structures are not amyloids. Another thing that is nice is that salt is known to increase the hydrophobic effect. So here it could be that that's what the effect is. So this is basically this pellet with water.
But I don't understand where you can see it's a single bundle of fibers. From your model, it could just be fibers at various scales and fill the cell in any case.
You
see this very clear visual.
Yeah. That's a very important point. We were not expecting at all to see like one single fiber. In fact, I didn't even expect to see fibers. I expected to see dots because I didn't expect that they would grow that long enough so that we can actually see them. Yeah. So that was, and this is still as of today a puzzling question.
But it's a lateral interaction as well.
So that means that it does interact laterally, yes.
Or it could just be a stereological effect. I mean, you're elongating that way in the same way that you will align crystals.
Yeah.
They just align even without lateral.
There was a paper in eLife last year where they it's an enzyme called CTP synthase, and under one particular stress condition, it starts forming fibers. And they tried to isolate those fibers, but they were super unstable. As soon as the cells were cracked open, they would dissolve. So maybe it's some kind of, I think it's a very interesting biophysical question. Why would these things automatically bundle together? I mean, in amyloids, what happens is that it grows in length, and then the lateral interactions individually are not strong enough. But acting like if you have 10, 20 units and you have huge avidity, and then maybe it's enough also to bring them together. Actually, we saw that in cryo-EM. Yeah.
Can you calculate the number?
So, in yeast, it would be thousands of units.
Sideways.
No. I mean, by the type of microscopy that we did, I think it's impossible. With super resolution, it could be actually.
Well, there's something I didn't understand. So this is the result of you selecting one protein, selecting three mutations, and then doing experiment, or is this a result of a screen where you tested many proteins and this was the only one that...
Yeah, okay. That's a very important question. This is here, I think for this one, we had two sets of mutations in two different places, and one gave fibers, one gave nothing.
Same protein, so we just tested this one protein.
Yeah, so I use it as a starter. Okay. But we did many proteins. So that's coming. So usually it never did nothing. Usually when it didn't do anything, it formed foci, but not fibers. But it usually did something, the mutations.
So foci is just aggregation.
That's the common intuition, but I mean, we don't know. I mean, it could be folded state aggregation, and we have good reasons to think that it is. I'll come to that as well. So the next thing that Hector did is to purify the protein and look at the structure by CD and the spectra of the wild type and the mutant superposed perfectly. So supposedly the structure is maintained. And in fact, it also binds zinc. And when we add zinc, the wild type and the mutant both change in the same way. So that's also a good indication that the protein maintained its structure. That answers your question, Sarah. This is a SEM of, so this is a yeast cell seen by SEM. That was a work of Eyal Cimoni. We did with him. He's working in the electron microscopy unit. And here you can see a bundle of fibers. So from this, one could say that, it's like almost half a micron wide. It's pretty big. And in some cases, and actually I just see that now, we in another, not with SAM, but with STEM, we saw that the fibers actually cross the nucleus. Like they, the cells are quite happy with them, and I just don't understand how it's possible. So this is a zoom in, and here you can see the individual bundles. So from this, we can say that we actually observed this transition, but this that doesn't really tell us about the frequency of that transition.
Is the concentration the same as with the wild-type? How do you know?
I didn't say so. One, this protein. So we actually let me go to the next slide. So this protein is a one pock here, is a E. coli protein, and actually all of these proteins are in the end proteins that we used, and they are all E. coli proteins. And the reason is that we expressed in yeast. The reason they are E. coli protein is that we didn't want the wild type and the mutants to be co-expressed together. So in that sense, it doesn't have, a native expression in yeast, but clearly, I think it's higher expression than when it should be in E. coli. Yet,
you're the control. The control is the wild type in yeast and the mutant in yeast.
Yeah.
Did you quantify by Western?
To see if it's the exact same abundance. No, it's the same promoter, and it's one point mutation. So I wouldn't expect that. The levels change a lot.
Well.
Yeah, but
I think that's an important experiment.
I will tell you what, I think you're right in the sense that I'm pretty sure that we will see an increase in concentration because the fibers are protected against degradation. But the thing is, to be protected, you need the seeds. You need the nucleation. And the nucleation means that the nucleation is only possible with a mutation, basically. This one part, even when we use the weakest promoter we have, we still see we see mini fibers. And then it's much weaker than the wild type, with a strong promoter. In that sense. But we should do a Western, actually.
I just question the statement that there is proteolytic protection in the fiber.
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you actually tested this?
No, I would guess so, but I don't know. There is in one or two cases that I know this is used as a mechanism to store the protein under this particular condition. So you don't have to degrade the protein, and it's ready for a change in condition. So you can store it as a fiber. And when the condition changes and you need the protein, it's there. But
one thing is, do you have any idea? Can you model the structure of the fiber? Because CTP synthase, if I remember correctly, it was like an S-shaped fiber.
No. This one is a Wolfgang Baumeister one you're talking about. That this structure? No. I don't.
There was one of the enzymes formed like an S-shaped kind of, So there's a twist in the.
I don't know. We if everything goes well within a month, we should have a structure of a fiber, but I don't know yet. I kind of know.
You told us early on that proteins sit on the scale from relatively sticky to non-sticky that is inversely correlated
yes.
with abundance.
Yes.
So where is one pop large on that scale?
So most of these proteins, we didn't.
Obviously, in E. coli, not in yeast, which is.
Yeah. Of course. So most of these proteins do. They are medium. I would say they are not super high. They are not super low. There is one or two that is very low. I would say that it samples the distribution of abundances. I don't have the numbers in mind, but I did work with it, and I tried to interpret that a posteriori, like which proteins form fibers. For example, we expected that the abundant proteins would be less prone to form fibers, but they weren't.
The important thing is where the mutations are.
Yes, you're right.
Within this.
Yeah, within your...
Yes, totally right. We will come to that. So.
How long are the fibers?
So the one I showed already was the size of the cell. I mean, it's as if the cell is the boundary.
So five
microns. And in fact, it's funny because sometimes like they bend as if they need more space. So.
But they don't exhibit random bending.
So I will go to the next slide. You will see. So we see different types actually. It's not homogeneous. So here we expressed all the wild types, and we always saw a homogeneous expression without any sign of aggregation. And when we express the mutants, in half of the cases we saw fibers. But the fibers, although here they all look the same, when you look at the population of cells, you see like pretty heterogeneous behavior in terms of the quantity of fibers, like how is it called? The penetrance, like of the fiber phenotype, varies. For example, this one POC with a single point mutation, every cell has a fiber, but some of these is more rare. So it's quite interesting. And in half of the cases we saw foci, and in the foci also we see very different phenotypes. So these foci, for example, were not super round. Sometimes we saw rather one foci per cell, sometimes multiple foci per cells, and that was seemed to be vary from one mutant to another. So I think this is quite interesting in terms of self-assembly. It's really interesting. These could be interesting models to understand the mechanisms of self-assembly in vivo. And for all these four proteins, a single point mutation was sufficient to trigger the formation of fibers. And then for all of them, Hector really did a tremendous work. Here we tried to monitor the structure by measuring the stability and the structure by circular dichroism. The funny thing is when we looked at the stability, this one is the same, but most of them were more stable. The mutants were more stable than the wild types. And this is probably because they formed the assemblies buried more surface and the interactions between the units gave it more stability. In fact, this one was so stable that we couldn't even denature it at 95 degrees. So the wild type is 80, and this one we have no idea. It's over 100. So and then by CD Hector still needs to fill up these slots, but hopefully soon it's going to be done. So the next thing that we did to actually get some structural details is to look at them by electron microscopy. And this we did with Sharon Wolf from the electron microscopy unit. And here it's very nice because you can see this is one fiber, so this is negative staining. It's quite terrible for the protein. I mean, it's a harsh treatment, and this is probably why the fibers don't look anything like what you've seen in vivo. So here we see one bundle that sticks to another bundle, and you can see the units that, and each unit that can be seen here matches the size of the structure, of the crystal structure. So that is known. So that's a good indication also that things are folded. This is the same protein, but seen by CryoTEM. And here you can see that, so CryoTEM is just with water, so these are more closer to native conditions, and you can see that it forms those microcrystals. Which makes it actually terribly hard to get a structure because it's in 3D and then one has to do tomography. This is another octamer that forms these fibers that are less well defined. These two cases were interesting because these were square homoligomers, but we were curious to see what would happen with pentamers because with a pentamer you cannot pave a regular surface. So when we looked at them, we saw different things. So this one, for example, you can see individual units, and here it forms fibers that bundle as pairs in a twisted fashion. And another one that is perhaps even more interesting forms these fibers that are mixed between order and non-ordered, between assembly and aggregation. So you can see some regularity. But it's clearly not super regular. And so here you can see actually it's as if this was a cross section, and you can see donuts, and each donut is one unit. But the donuts assemble in a very heterogeneous fashion. So I think this example is great in the sense that it really highlights that the frontier between assembly and aggregation is quite ill defined. When do you say it's assembly? When do you say it's aggregation? I still don't have the answer. Then we look at we looked at those that form foci in cells, and two of them actually, for two of them, we saw fibers. So in the end, if we summarize the results, we are left with only three proteins that just form amorphous aggregates. And yet, at least this one we know is stable, even in fact, is more stable than the wild type. So these amorphous aggregates, I would think, probably are made of folded homoligomers. It's just that they tend to stick to each other. So so then came a fundamental question, which is, so are they, can we somehow rationalize why some mutations formed fibers and some mutations didn't? So one property that we thought of was the most simple property, which is, can the mutation see itself on the other on another unit? So we defined what we called a distance to the closest bounding plane. So the bounding plane is this rectangle. So it bounds the homoligomer. And then we bin all the residues into distance, which is calculated by the normal to the plane. So here you have these residues are closest to the plane. Then you have these ones, etc. And so when we plot the distance, so the distance of the mutations as a function of the phenotype, we see that there is a statistically significant trend whereby mutations that do trigger fibers tend to be closer to the bounding plane, which simply means that they are more able to interact with each other. So if you put two leucines here, that means that they will be able to contact each other. Obviously, if the leucines are here, they might interact laterally, but not on the n-fold axis of symmetry side. So when we saw that, we thought, maybe then, let's check whether those regions that apparently are more dangerous in terms of fiber formation are more protected against fiber formation. So so to check that, what Charlie did was to take all the structures from PDB and calculate this distance and assign this distance to every residue. And so here, the distance is plotted on each structure. So you can see that the residues that are most towards you are more blue, which means that they are more dangerous, whereas the residues that are towards the center of the structure are less dangerous. And so when we plot, so then we thought, okay, so let's plot the stickiness of the residues as a function of their distance on the structure. So here, that's what we do for the cyclic dimers. So here, so to explain again, imagine that you have one axis of symmetry that goes like this. So you have a plane, and the first residues that are encountered when you, so you have a virtual plane that you move along the axis of symmetry. And the first residues that it's going to encounter are in this bin. Then it's going to encounter other residues and other residues, etc. So here we plot the stickiness as we enter into the structure. So we see that at the beginning.
I mean, it seems really clever, but how can you, because you can slice it in any way.
No, so it's the axis of symmetry. So you take the axis of symmetry, because the axis of symmetry gives you the cooperativity of the residues. So these two residues will, so if you come along the axis of symmetry, you will touch residues that can act in pairs or in triplets or quadruplets, etc. If you take with any other plane.
No, because you can. I mean, the dimer axis of symmetry doesn't determine the tetramer axis of symmetry.
No, but these are only dimers. This is exclusively dimers. So for example, if you have a residue here, you will have the same residue here. So as you enter, you will see both residues. Both residues will be in the same bin. But then I'm worried because if you have a, if it's not clear, then I'm sure like everybody's lost.
No, sorry, I was just
So please tell me.
It's the distance to itself and then the basically geometric.
So maybe it's clear on the D2. So
yeah. So
here we have, imagine that here you have an axis of symmetry going up the screen. You take a virtual plane and you enter it into the structure. So you will first encounter these two parts of the structure. And so these two parts of the structure will be in the outside bin, and then as you move inside and inside and inside, it will change bin. So for the cyclic, we see that it's more flat than for the dihedral. So the dihedral, these regions are supposedly more dangerous, and from what we see here, they are less sticky. So that's, I mean, that's as expected. So that means that here the regions that are thought to be dangerous are richer in non-sticky amino acids. So we did it for, so why is it flat for cyclics? The reason is that, I mean, for a cyclic complex, if it acquires a new set of interaction, it will form a dihedral. It will not form an uncontrollable assembly. So that's that's what we think why the cyclics are not subject to this change in stickiness as a function of this distance. The interesting thing is that if we take C2s and D2s, the mutation will only two copies of the mutation will be able to act together. But if you take higher order symmetries, it will more and more mutations will be able to act together. So we looked at this for C2s, but also for, so here says the delta in stickiness is 0.03. For C3s, and then we see that the cyclic is again stable, and the dihedral here is has a lower stickiness, and then it increases. So the dangerous region is again less sticky. We looked at C4, and we saw the same thing. And we looked at C5, and we saw again the same thing. So the more mutations you can get together, the more it seems that the surface is adapted to avoid non-specific interactions, basically, or non-adaptive interactions. So then I guess especially because of the topic of the course, the question is: so what about evolution? What about evolutionary conservation of these mutations? One might think that if the mutations are dangerous, then the position that leads to fibers, which are thought to be dangerous, should be more conserved. However, what we saw was nothing. Like, there is absolutely no conservation signal. Whether the mutation led to a fiber or a foci or nothing, there was absolutely no difference in conservation. We were a bit disappointed by this result, but I mean, in the end, I guess what it means is that every surface on the protein is adapted to, is tuned to its level of dangerosity, but then it can evolve within it can freely evolve within that window. Do you see what I mean? So another possibility is that maybe the fibers are just not dangerous. Yeah?
What evolutionary distance are we talking about here?
Evolutionary distance.
So what organisms are you comparing?
So here, actually, for this one, it was very not controlled. It was just all the homologs with between 40% and 90% sequence identity. That was the what we used. So sometimes, depends on the protein, sometimes you get 20 homologs, sometimes you get 200. So we just controlled the divergence of the sequence, but not... Yeah, we could do the same, actually, analysis with... the same set of autologs for
probably be worth it. I think they're suggesting and easy to do to take a set of proteins that you have one-to-one orthologs across all of life, and we can give you a list of 200 or so proteins that fall in that category.
Okay. Okay.
Of which, I mean, you'd have to look at them and see how many have structural information available.
Yeah.
How do you know that the set of the same structure?
That's why we capped the divergence of the sequence. That could help explain why. I mean, I completely agree. I mean, this is not. In fact, it was funny because when Hector looked at it a long time ago, he looked at the multiple alignments, and for this one POG, the first protein we looked at. And at the position where he made the fiber-inducing mutation was present in one of the organisms, and that was a Weitzmann bug. And since we are in Weitzmann Institute, it was fine. Another simple explanation is that there are like strong epistatic effects, which we actually have seen. So you have one point mutation and it makes a fiber. I'm sure that we could make another mutation. that would also maybe even increase the stickiness, and it would kill the fiber. So if there are strong epistatic effects, and since the surface is evolving so quickly, I mean, that could easily maybe explain that as well.
If you have a number of residues involved in your one mutation off, then you can go naturally to five mutation off from being sticky, and then you can change that residue back.
Yeah.
You know, you just move around and
you
don't pass the threshold.
Yeah. I will.
It doesn't need to be epistatic. It can be like a sum of things.
You
drift in that sum of things, and sometimes you get further, and then you can come back with these mutations.
I
was just going to ask if you ever see sticky mutations fixed in any of these related proteins that you've looked at. Evolutionary conservation.
Yeah.
Did you go further and look at
That's something that Charlie did that actually. I'm presenting it the other way around, but Charlie looked at this before we did the experiments.
Yeah.
And we tried to put it in every possible way. We couldn't. I mean, we were really disappointed because we are looking for that signal. We tried to look at every possible way. We could never find some signal for conservation.
Because building on Kristen's idea, you might, if you do see one, you know, Kristen's idea would say you probably have a lot of pro-solubility amino acids around it.
So I mean, when I sent back the figure to Charlie, I think it told me something like, when we took this protein and did that filter and that filter and looked only at the hydrophilic to hydrophobic mutations, maybe like we saw some weak signal, but I was never convinced. So I would like to propose the opposite, that maybe these mutations are evolving faster, specifically because, people are always thinking about mutations that are dangerous, positions that are dangerous, which often is the core of the protein has been conserved. But the thing is, the core of the protein is constant. Its goal is to be constant, whereas the surface of the protein sees the exterior, which is constantly changing. So in that sense, maybe some conditions can have the effect of the mutation, in which case the protein would have to adapt to counter the changing environment. So in that sense, the next step, what I wanted to do, I haven't done it yet, is to look at for positive selection at these positions.
Well, what if there's an interaction partner that's present in one species, and you prevent that?
Yeah, it's possible. You could cap
fiber formation. Right? Yeah, you just see something else.
Yeah, you could cap it. The only thing is that to have an efficient cap, you could have like one protein binding very tightly. But the avidity of the homoligomer here will really outcompete easily any monomeric partner.
Yeah.
So maybe you can have a tetrameric or pentameric partner as well. But the thing is, this can also be explained in a way, as we know that the main driver of evolutionary conservation is not whether protein. It's not say whether an amino acid is at the core or at the surface. The main driving force in evolutionary conservation is expression. That's just to show you a picture of what this looks like. This looks like it should be bad on the fitness. Like you have this cell and you have the fiber spanning the cell. Especially that something we noticed. I don't know if there is an example on this slide. I don't think there is, but. These fibers, they tend to lag the butt sites. So as soon as the cell starts to divide, it will just have affinity to the butt site and grow in the daughter cell. And then the yeast will actually manage to break it in two, and it will start again. It's really funny to check, to look at in the microscope. When we first saw that, we thought that the impact on fitness should be drastic. But we saw in some cases an impact on fitness, but in many cases we didn't detect any. And in fact, in one case, the fiber-forming mutant gives better fitness because overexpressing the protein is pretty bad for the cell. But I guess the fiber kind of decreases the activity of the protein and makes the cells more happy. It's quite funny. So this is just to show you one example for still the same one POC protein. These are growth curves. So this is log scale. So this is the slope is the rate. In green, you have all the mutants that don't form fibers, that are homogeneous or form foci, actually. In red, you have the fiber-forming mutants. And you can see that they are all in the same range. These two outliers are all the wild-type protein, actually. But then when we put the protein on a high expression plasmid, we do see a very strong effect on the fitness. So here it's really expression dependent. But this is really among the top 1% expression in the cell. So one might think that for proteins, I mean, if they remain at a low expression, like having a weak self-interaction might not be that bad for the fitness, and so they are just free to evolve in that sense. So I think that we are reaching the end, a bit early. So to summarize, we saw that the natural state of a protein surface is actually to be close to becoming quite sticky. That in homomers, just increasing the stickiness is enough to trigger a new self-interaction. And that those regions that are most dangerous have actually tuned the stickiness to probably to minimize this effect. And then as a graphical summary, so we saw that the cell is a highly crowded environment and that a point mutation can make a difference. So one could say, I like this analogy. This is like a dense floor and where beer would be the hydrophobic effect. And so cells are living on a cliff, meaning that a point mutation can really change the phenotype as in the fibers. But I guess this is actually a positive trait in the sense that living on that cliff enables you to jump to other cliffs through few mutations. So as, for example, in forming large complex assemblies as in the ribosome. So with that, I'll thank the group. So Hector did all of the experimental work, actually. And Charlie did all of the computational work. And and thank you for your attention.
So we know that a lot of proteins in the cell can form homomers.
Yes.
So that's the starting point. So considering what we just heard here, my expectation would be that given any species, that if I was imaging any protein that's forming a homomer, I'd have a high likelihood of finding fiber. That's, however, is somehow rare. In fact, that the few fibers that we found, that filamentous enzymes, are a big thing because they're so rare. So I'm finding hard to reconcile this idea that you just told us very well, that this is so easy, but somehow nature doesn't seem to be doing it.
So the question is, so can the fiber have an important functional role? Because of the nature of the fiber, which is uncontrollable assembly, because it's infinite by nature, I guess that it tries to avoid it. Most of the time, it's avoiding forming the fibers. It's easy to form, but it is avoiding it. So I guess this is the answer. But in many cases, maybe that people overlook it because they think it's an artifact. So, like when biochemists work with a protein and the protein precipitates, few biochemists will take the pellets and put it in an electron microscope. So to see many of these fibers, what Hector does, he just takes the pellets of the protein precipitate in the electron microscope and we see the fibers of the folded proteins. So I think people also overlook it because they think it's just junk. And so I think there are two effects. Nature is avoiding it because it cannot control it, and people are avoiding it because it's very hard to characterize. Like, for example, you cannot use classic methods to characterize the oligomeric state because they don't have a well-defined oligomeric state. So it's very hard. We had a very hard time to work with them. I mean, actually, Hector had a very hard time. But so I think these are the main two components that could explain why we don't see them.
Second question. So in most of your mutants, you have these long fibers that apparently they go into the... They are inherited by the region. But you had a couple of cases in which you have small fibers.
Yeah.
Are they heritable? Do you actually inherit the fibers? Do you regenerate fibers in the daughter cell?
We didn't do... Yeah, we would need to do like time-lapse microscopy to really understand what's happening. Only in the case of one POC, we did one time-lapse, and that's when we saw, in one case, fiber growing into the daughter cell, being split in two, and starting again. But we didn't do it systematically, so it's hard to, it would be just as a self-assembly problem. I think it's super interesting. Is it that you have to reach a critical concentration and then you see the fiber rising, or do you have nucleation from the start? I don't know.
In terms of thickness, wouldn't it be nicer to look at the proteins from the yeast itself so that you could change the endogenous protein? Like a protein that would be completely
We wanted to use there is a knockout collection for E. coli now, but we never went because it's not much, but you need to change the plasmid and to change the selection, and so, and also it's good that Hector started with that many proteins, but it makes any new analysis a nightmare because now you have to do it on.
You keep mentioning something about enzyme activity, but it was not clear to me. Are these things enzymes? Do they retain activity when they form fibers, or are they become inactive?
For two or three of them, Hector could show that they still bind the ligand, but we haven't done in vitro assay for activity. There is one of them that could be relatively easy to assay, but it's not that easy. One POC actually is terrible, is the worst, because you need to purify three or four enzymes to actually test the affinity of this one. So we don't know. The simple thing, what we wanted to do is see if any one of them is essential and see if E. coli can live on with it, with the fiber-forming mutant, but we haven't done it yet.
Is there some reason why a protein should be more likely to aggregate with itself than with something else?
Of course. I mean,
like why don't you get ABABAB kind of fibers?
So in that case, it's very simple. Is that the specificity comes from the geometry? So here you have four mutations, and the protein itself is perfectly positioned to be complementary. So in that case, the avidity comes from the self complementarity, which is only itself, because no other protein has the exact same geometry in the cell. But generally speaking, so Shaknovich had many papers showing that, and Mono coined it in a very simple way, that with a homo-oligomer, you get one genetic mutation. For one, you get two for free. I mean, you buy one, you get one for free. So you have one mutation, and you get two mutations. So twice as often, you will have a bad interaction. So it won't lead to a new interaction, but twice more often, or even more, because it's like if you plot the energy landscape, it's in the tail, and the tail is actually much higher. So you get significantly higher propensity for self-interactions. There is even like a PRL paper from the 80s showing this, not on proteins, but just that symmetry really is favorable energetically. If you're interested, I could.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.